This is Eleanor Swent, and I'm interviewing Harry Conger in Walnut Creek, California on December 9th, 1999. I think we need a little louder volume. Let's try that. All right, now we're repeating some from a previous interview, but so let's repeat your birth date and then talk a little more about...
Which will lead us into those years when I was a young person, a very young person, okay. I was born in Seattle, Washington on July 22nd, 1930.
Beginning of the Depression.
The beginning of the Depression, 1929, just passed. My dad had gone to the University of Washington for a couple of years. He was a good athlete, particularly in track and also basketball.
What was your father's name?
Harry M. Conger, Jr.
No. Oh, he was junior also.
No, I'm the third.
Oh?
Red's the fourth. Red's son. Harry is the fifth, Cinco.
My goodness.
Yeah, so.
That's wonderful.
And a little aside on that, the opportunity occurred that my grandfather, my father, I, and Red were living at the same time. So we had a picture taken of the four of us.
Isn't that wonderful?
And then, fortunately, we were able to have a picture of, many years later, my father, me, Red, and Harry. So we got two sets of pictures that span, what would that be, eight? Well, anyhow, five generations, actually.
Mm-hmm. That's wonderful.
In two pictures, so that was sort of fun.
That really is great.
At any rate, I was the eldest son of the family. And firstborn, obviously. My dad, as I start to say, was going to University of Washington, and really as much interested in sports as he was in academics, and more qualified for sports than academics. And I can't even tell you what his course was, but as a freshman. They're all pretty general anyhow. But at any rate, after 2 years in college and not really doing too well in sports because there's a lot of competition and certainly not in school, he married my mom, dropped out of school, and was working for his father, who had a garage and gas station right there in the university district in Seattle. And it was the Depression. So Dad was working for his dad. Mom and Dad lived in an apartment, and I was born in July of 1930. And that was just after the Depression. And it wiped my grandfather's business out. He owed the bank some money for the business. He couldn't meet the call and lost the business. So that must have happened in about 1932 or maybe 33 that he lost the business. So my dad then got a job working for a pipe fabricating company over in Provo, Utah, right next to the steel mill. And so we moved over there, and Dad was a safety engineer there. And how he got the job, because jobs were so hard to get in those days. My mother's uncle was a manager of the plant. He was a mechanical engineer and the manager of the plant. And so he gave Dad a job, fortunately. My grandfather, who lost his livelihood too, went back east to Washington, D.C., which is where many of his brothers, he was one of 13 children.
Oh my.
And So he had several brothers that had a laundry back in Washington, D.C. And so my granddad moved back there and set up a landscaping business, doing commercial landscaping for office buildings and so forth. And so we went to Utah. We were there for 2 years, I think it was. I started kindergarten there, so it must have been, 33 when we went there. And then I went to kindergarten in the basement of Brigham Young University, which at that time was two buildings right downtown in Provo, before they moved out to their big campus. And so here in the basement of this university or college, that was where the kindergarten was. So I went to kindergarten. And
were your mother's family Mormons?
No. Episcopalians. My mother's father was an Episcopal minister.
In Provo?
No. Back east in Toledo, Ohio, and he died as a very young man. He's about 45, 46 years old, died of a heart attack. And mom was, and my grandmother was a widow from then on, lived to be 82 or 83 or so. But no, Episcopal.
I was going to ask, too, how your family came to the Northwest. Had they?
Well, my mother's family, first of all, came to the Northwest. That's a story in itself. They were all from Pennsylvania, my mother's family, her mother and her brothers and sisters.
What was their family name?
Their name was Sibbett, S-I-B-B-E-T-T. They grew up in around Brownsville in Pennsylvania, and were comfortable.
Brownsville.
They were comfortable, but not wealthy by any means. But the one brother that I mentioned, George Sibbett, was a mechanical engineer, and worked his way through college, and was practicing mechanical engineering. One of the sisters, Aunt Mary, married a doctor, and one of the other sisters was an old maid. I just don't recall the rest, but that's sort of the core of the family. Anyhow, they got wiped out by a charlatan who a very attractive young man started courting Aunt Mary, I can't remember her name now, but she was the old maid aunt, as it turns out. But as a young woman, she's a beautiful young girl. And so everybody was delighted. She was the eldest of the family, and everybody's delighted that she had a beau, because she had been to school and everything, but wasn't married in those days. You had to get married. So here this handsome guy shows up, and she'd have him home to dinner with the family, and he was just delightful, and everybody loved him, and they were so happy about it. One day he shows up, and he told him he was in business. Well, this time he showed up for dinner with a little package, and he said he was in the mining business, in a gold mine. He has a gold mine. And on the dining room table, he says, on this brick of gold. He said, this is our first production out of the mine. Huh? And so we're going to expand the mine. We're going to take in some investors and so forth. And so everybody's sitting there and thinking, don't know a thing about gold mining. But we sure want the sister to have this husband, because he's so attractive. So, we'll invest some with you too. Oh, wow. And so they put money in, the guy took off. And virtually wiped him out.
Oh.
So they just picked up and moved to Seattle. Mm-hmm. And so that's sort of how my mother's side got there. My dad.
But you were no doubt reared with this story.
Oh, yeah.
The family story. Be careful.
Yeah, Well, it's sort of funny that I wound up in the gold mining business with my brick.
That's wonderful.
Anyhow, so that, and so this was the same Uncle George, that family that now had moved west, and he was wiped out. The whole family sort of collectively invested in this thing, sort of wanting to help their sister along. And so he subsequently got this job as manager of this pipe plant. He's a very capable guy. And later on, he moved to California and formed a steel fabricating company called Coulter Sibbett, which Lee Emerson and the guys, Carlson, knew of this company down in Southern California, that like Soule Steel here in San Francisco, same kind of business. And so he, you know, he's a very successful guy and a very capable guy. So, getting back to those Depression years.
Well, and also, how did the Conger family happen to come out?
Okay,
to
now
Seattle?
I'm not as clear. how my grandfather first got to Seattle. His history was one. He had no formal education. But he was a very entrepreneurial and innovative person, sort of taciturn and stern. Dad always, you know, was in trouble for one thing or another with his dad. Oh. Dad was the youngest of five, and he had four older sisters. So he sort of got the blessing and curse of that situation. But my grandfather, early on, he must have been in his 30s, perhaps, or yeah, probably 30s. He became acquainted with a guy that had this process to put cellophane, you know, to wrap it around things. And one of the things that it became immediately useful for was wrapping up cigarette packages, so the cigarettes wouldn't go stale. And so he went down to North Carolina, I guess, and built the machine and helped them set up how to wrap these cigarettes in this cellophane and get it going. And he made quite a bit of money at that. And so he took this money and gave it to two of his brothers who were out in Seattle to invest in a sawmill, which was Seattle Cedar Sawmill. And they'd take cedar from Alaska and make beautiful, beautiful siding with this cedar, these huge trees. Because later on, when I was going to college, I worked there at the sawmill in the summertime. They took Grandpa's investment and used it to build this business up. And then they didn't give him the proper credit for having invested in that. They sort of didn't do right by him on that. So he sort of lost that money. And I think it was $80,000 or something, which was a tremendous amount of money back then.
Yeah.
Would have been probably before 1920. Mm. So that was a huge sum of money. Mm. So anyhow, he lost. He didn't have the use of it. And so then he moved back after. Then he got into that service station business, which is what my dad in garage repair garage. And so forth. My dad worked for him when he quit school, and until my grandfather lost that business must have been 32 or 33. So he moved to Provo. We were there for 2 years working at the pipe plant Dad was. And he continued his interest in athletics. He was a field judge for the track meets for Brigham Young. So he, you know, we'd all go up on weekends when the track meets were on. And Dad officiated at those, you know, he was a starter for the races and so forth. So he kept active in that for years and played handball for years as well. So he, you know, kept active in sports.
When did you start your tennis?
I didn't start until I came here.
Oh, really?
California, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
I thought maybe that would be a lifelong.
No, I was a high school football, basketball, and track and all that stuff, but a small school, so you didn't have to be very good to be good there, and I was good there, but I was at a small school. So Dad kept, you know, active doing that for years. So then
Provo
we left Provo probably in about 1935 or 36. A company took over the pipe plant, and they brought in their own manager.
Oh dear!
So Uncle George was dispossessed of his job, which happened. You know, we see it happen all the time.
Yeah, but
ourselves. That's when Uncle George came out to California and worked around until he could start this new business with Coulter. So we then were out of work. Mm-hmm. So we went back to Seattle, and we're just there for the shortest time. And then I don't know where Dad got the money, he must have saved up for it, but they bought a brand new 1935 or 1936 sedan, you know, 6-passenger sedan.
What kind was it?
Well, it probably was a Ford or a Chevy, but I don't recall. It was black. As all of Henry's stuff was, and I guess probably all of the other guys' cars were black too, but it's a black car. And so we loaded up, my mom and Dad, me, and I must have been about 5 then, my cousin, who was probably 9 or 10, his mother, my dad's sister, and their dog Rufus. So we all piled into this car, and we take off for Washington, D.C.
My goodness.
And drove cross country.
Mm.
And going across Nebraska and Kansas, most of the roads were dirt, you know, just these section line roads, but they weren't paved yet. And we slept in the car. We didn't have, and of course in those days there probably weren't even any motels to stay at. But we'd just sleep out in the middle of Kansas and Nebraska and then in Illinois. And it must have taken us a week. It seemed like forever.
Oh, at least, yeah.
All of us piled in this car.
Well, it would have taken more than a week.
Yeah, whatever. It took.
The summer, it must have been in the...
It must have been summer, because I don't remember being snowy or cold or anything. No. Yeah, so it had to be summer, you're right.
What a fantastic trip.
Yeah, it was a fantastic trip.
And of course, your father, I suppose, did all the driving.
I think so.
Did your mother drive?
She did later, and I assume she could
maybe,
drive, but
maybe so.
But in any case, you know, there was a lot of traveling at 40 and 45 miles an hour.
Quite a trip.
Yeah. So anyhow, we got there, and Dad went to work for his dad in this fertilizer business. We lived down in Chesapeake Bay, and so Dad and my grandfather would commute into Washington every day, and had a crew of people doing the work for him. And
you were on the Maryland side?
On Maryland side, Chesapeake Bay, yeah. In an area that had no electricity. It was really rural, right on a canal that goes right into the bay, Deal County. And so we were in a place with no electricity. We had kerosene lanterns and a pump, a hand pump out in the back to pump water for the house and an outhouse. So we lived there for probably almost a year. I guess it was.
You would have been going to school by
then. And I was going to school. That was another school I was in. I can't remember how many schools I was in before we got to where I finally went to high school. But in school,
the town?
You know, it was Deal County, and there was no town. There was a rural school. Eight grades, two rooms, and each row was a grade kind of thing. And by that time, I must have been first grade, maybe. Probably first grade. So just a small school.
Was it far from where you lived? Did you walk to school?
I did walk to school. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. It wasn't more than a mile. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was close. And, you know, new kid. You had to sort of fight your way through the yard and make friends and stuff, which is all a good experience.
What did you do for lunch?
At that school, I can't remember. At another school we went to, kids would bring potatoes and stuff, and onions, and they'd make soup. You know, that was, everybody would bring something, and then somebody, I can't remember who, maybe it was a teacher, because that was another two-room schoolhouse for the first eight grades. They made lunch.
For heaven's sake.
With the stuff there.
Never heard of that.
Yeah. But at that school, I don't recall what we did for lunch. We might have gone home, but I just don't recall that. Mm-hmm.
Were there other siblings by then?
No. I was an only child. For quite a while.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of fits into this whole story, too.
Okay.
So we lived there for about a year, and then my grandfather bought a place. We were renting this place, and bought a place over in Virginia, just out of Falls Church, which is, you know, just across Potomac from Washington, D.C., which was handier for their business. It brought them a little closer to their business. This was a farm. It must have had 10 or 12 acres or something like that. And a really quite a nice big house. But we did, Mom and Dad and I didn't live in that house. There was an outbuilding that was a less nice house that we lived in. And grandfather and Dad's sister, who was, I think she was divorced, because I never did know her husband, or my cousin's father. I never, or he may have died. But in any case, she was single. And I guess he died because we used to see his father once in a while, old Mr. Cook. And he was a cantankerous old guy, and he didn't like the Congers. So I don't even remember how it was we went to his house to see him, because he didn't like it. So I guess it was my grandfather who didn't like it.
This was in Seattle?
No, this was back in...
He was there.
And he lived in Maryland, in Silver Springs, Maryland, on the other side of Washington. So, at any rate...
So Grandpa lived in the big house.
Yeah. I mentioned that he had all these brothers and sisters. Well, a couple of the brothers had a laundry in Washington, D.C., Conger's Laundry. But my grandfather didn't have any interest in it, so he had nothing to do with it other than our brothers, my dad's uncles, owned two laundries in Washington. It was a pretty big business. So we were there all that time, which probably was another 2 years, probably back in the East, 3 years total maybe. And so I went to a much larger school now in Falls Church, very near Alexandria. There for maybe 2 years, and we all lived together. We were in this one building, and my grandfather and his daughter and my cousin lived in the other one. And So this now gets us to about 1938 or something like that. So we're there that long. What would that be? 35 to... Yeah, 35, 36. Yeah, about 38. And so we sort of came to a fork in the road, our family, our little, the three of us, my mom and dad, sort of came to a fork in the road. One night they called me into their bedroom. And we sat around on their bed and they said, well, Dad said, Harry, your mother's going to have a baby. And so now, by now I'm 8 years old or something like that. And so I said, yeah, good. And so they said, we're trying to decide if we should stay here in the East or move back to Seattle. One of the reasons to move back to Seattle is that my mother's uncle was a doctor, and he had birthed me, and she would like him to do that for the second child. So that was a strong incentive to go back, but then having decided that she'd like to do that, do we want to move back there or stay here? So they asked me, what would you like to do? And I said, I'd like to move back. And I don't know why, you know, a little kid, how would I know anything? 8 years old and lived in all these different places, how would I know?
How amazing, though, yeah, that they consulted you.
Yeah, it was really amazing. And I've always just thought about that. That's sort of extraordinary.
Must have made you feel pretty important.
Yeah, yeah. So they said, okay, we'll do that. And so they bought two train tickets, one for Mom and one for me, and Dad was going to stay and continue working. She had to go, you know, be prenatal, mm-hmm. I'm sure. Now I know that at that time I didn't know anything about any of this timing, but anyhow, we preceded Dad. We took the train across, and I think he drove, but I really forget how he got back to the West Coast. But
that must have been a memorable train trip.
It was. Third class, no amenities, sitting on those wooden seats. I can still remember them. Wooden seats. And so here we started across the country on the train. And when we got to Chicago, which are these huge yards, you know, mm-hmm. for switching and all that, our car, because it was third class or whatever class it was in those days, got set off and didn't get picked up. And it was during the night. And when we woke up in the morning, Mom and I were the only ones in the car. And there was all these cars around and all these tracks. And we're just sitting out there in the middle of all of this. Alone. And so, after a while, Mom saw some guy walking across the yard, and she goes out the end of the car and says, why are we here? The guy said, you shouldn't be on that train. What are you doing there? So he took us clear across all these tracks to the terminal. And they just set this car off and didn't realize we were on it and left us there. And poor Mom. With her luggage and everything and me and having to get this stuff to the terminal and then catch another train. So we must have been there a day and a half or something like that to get back on a train to go across. So that must have taken 5 or 6 days to get back. So it was tough on Mom, who was must be, by this time she must have been 4 or 5 months pregnant. So anyhow. We got back to Seattle, and so then my brother was born in August of 1939.
Were you living with family then?
Yes, and that's a key point to this long story. My mother's sister lived in Yakima, Washington, which is sort of the south center part of the state. And so we stayed with them. They had a large house. My Uncle Harry was, his family had come over from Scotland and early on got in, discovered this coal mine up on the summit of Snoqualmie Pass, right next to the Northern Pacific's coal mine. These four Scotchmen, located these coal measures, and so they started up a coal mine, and that was quite profitable in those early years for them. So the their family, my aunt's family, she and her husband and their only child, were well off. So they had a very nice house in the suburbs of Yakima. So we stayed in there. We stayed with them until my brother was born. And my uncle, my mother's brother-in-law, had invested in a brewery out in Sela, which is just 4 miles out of Yakima, a little bedroom community. Apple ranching was the key activity there. So my dad got a job through my uncle there. And so then we moved to Sela, and by this time I must be 9 years old, and so that's where I stayed till I graduated from high school, and that's where I met Phyllis. We were in the same grade, and so we grew up from then on, and spent the rest of her life together from that time on. So that's finally where I got to some place that we stayed from the third or fourth grade until I graduated from high school. So that was the depression. So those were my ideas about how the world was, and out of that, the best thing that could have happened to me was my appreciation for having a job, no matter what it is. If you just have a job and get the opportunity to work and do a good job, you'll be rewarded for that. And you know, and not what the job is so much as to have the job.
Sounds as if there was a lot of family closeness there too.
Yes, but it, you know, it was difficult. It was not all. You know, it makes you close, but yet it's a lot of stress and strife along with that too. So
worries,
yeah, a lot
Real
of worries,
worries,
a lot of worries. So, yes, closeness, but stress too. Yeah.
You have good health throughout.
We never had any kind of illness that was debilitating in any way. No, we were fortunate to all be healthy.
Okay, so now you have your little brother. What was his
name? He and I, we grew up for 9 years together, from the time I was nine until I left high school at 18, left home. And we had a great relationship, but it wasn't close because our ages were so different.
That's too much.
But he was the neatest guy, and still is to this day. He's one of the most wonderful.
I remember
wonderful,
meeting him at one of your parties.
He's just one of the most wonderful people in the world.
And what's his name?
George.
George. Looks a lot like you.
Yeah, people say that. I don't see it, but people say that.
No.
But it just the best natured young person, always happy, always busy, just really a neat guy, and interested in athletics, not too interested in books, didn't go for that much, but just a wonderful person. So we had a good 9 years together, but it wasn't close because of our age difference. And you know, my friends would come over and they'd all be high school kids, and you'd be a 9 year old kid or a 10 year old kid or whatever.
Yeah.
So at any rate, yeah.
So
that, you know, the topic we were on was the depression. I guess I guess that's what I, and in the earlier interview we had, I mentioned that was a blessing and a curse. And you know, as I think about it, there really was no curse to it. It was all positive, because you know, you learned so much from that, and we survived it very well.
Although there must have been a lot of worries on your parents' part those years.
I'm sure they were worried.
Of course they were.
But other than the stress I mentioned, that's the only manifestation I saw of that worry. And you know, we never went without food or anything. No. I always had clothes. So
we were talking a little earlier about the New Deal, I guess. The social issues of those days. Was there discussion of that in your family? Do you remember it?
No, you know,
in
I don't.
In Washington, I wondered.
I don't remember. When we left the East and came to the West Coast, it was just 2 years before the war broke out. And of course that changed everything politically. I know my parents were always Republicans and didn't agree with the social engineering that Roosevelt was imposing on the country. But that all sort of fell in the background, as you would remember, when the war broke out. It was us. It was not us and them anymore. It was all us. You know, we were all getting this done, and Roosevelt's there, and okay, so he's going to run for the third term. We voted for Wilkie, well, my folks did. But regardless of who won, this is our country, and we're going to. My dad was too old by that time to go to go into the service, so he didn't. But that changed everything. As far as the depression was gone, everybody's working.
Of course, now in Yakima, what were the effects of the?
Well,
there
was no defense activity there.
Not there.
But what was there was an artillery range within a few miles of this town.
Sela.
Yeah, and so we had a lot of soldiers there for a couple of years, about 3 or 4 years, I guess. And we would, I remember we'd, Mom and Dad would bring some of the guys home, and we'd have Sunday dinner together. But there was no defense activity there that Dad could have worked at.
So you were actually, let's see, when did you graduate from high school?
In 49.
So you were still in elementary school during the war.
Yeah.
Were you aware of the Japanese internment at all? Were there Japanese around there?
Yes, there were. They had some truck farms just outside of Yakima on the way to our little town, driving out of Yakima towards Sela. There were some Japanese truck farms, and the vegetables that they grew there were just beautiful, beautiful row on row on row of these beautiful plants with peas and all kinds of things, better than anybody else in that area grew. And they were gone. You know, one day they were gone. These people were gone, and the fields just went like that, died. Just awful. And I can't remember anybody really being mad about it or saying, it isn't that awful. We all felt bad that nobody was taking such good care of these crops. And I, as a younger person, didn't associate that with what we were doing to those people who had been born there. You know, they're an easy Japanese. But I didn't know all of that then.
No.
And I don't recall hearing any conversation at home about that. So it didn't ring very high with my parents, obviously. I'd heard them say something about it. So there was that experience, which is just sort of a brush, because I didn't know where they went.
No.
I didn't even know their interment. They were just gone.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, there was no, maybe there was here in California, but there was no discussion of where these people went. I don't remember ever hearing. I really don't know if my parents knew where they
went. You don't recall that there were children in your school that...
No, out where we were. We were far enough away that they wouldn't have gone to our school anyhow.
I see.
But that would have been a good sign.
More,
yeah. But no, they were not in our school, so so I didn't have that as a gauge for what happened. And I never knew anyone, even though as I got older, I knew people in Yakima. I never knew of anyone that recounted that, said, you know, one day these kids are gone, which is what happened.
I think that's what many of us feel. We went through that and somehow never even noticed.
Now, were you out here then, or were you still in Leeds? You were still in Leeds, and there were no Japanese there.
No.
Yeah.
No. We weren't even aware of that whole thing happening. It was just...
Until, you know, it all came out later.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we read now so many things about that time that we lived through and how little we knew about so many things.
Mm-hmm.
I was just reading a book review a day or so ago about recounting those years where in 1939, we had cracked the encrypted code of the Japanese for the ambassadors.
Mm-hmm.
So that happened in August, and they didn't bomb us till December.
Mm-hmm.
So there is no direct tie from that ability to the White House. But it's incredible to think that these guys who cracked the code didn't tell somebody that got to Cordell Hull, who was Secretary of State then, and Roosevelt. It's incredible to think that they didn't know that.
It really is.
Yeah. So, more circumstantially, they knew it.
Mm-hmm.
But remember, Roosevelt had trouble getting Congress to let him have money to go to Europe to fight Hitler.
Mm-hmm.
And so the only way to really precipitate this was to have them abuse us. And they sure as heck did in Pearl Harbor. Yeah, so, and I can remember this as a young guy, probably in high school by now, but Mom and I were the one to talk politics all the time. Mom said, they knew that it was going to be bombed. And this had to be 1945, 46, something. Because she read a lot of this stuff that wasn't, you know, the New York Times stuff. These were other publications that cast aspersions on the Roosevelt administration and stuff. So you know, it was known then, but the major media never...
No.
Never said a word about it.
No.
So, there was a lot that went on that we didn't know a thing about.
People weren't as well informed.
Yeah, and that's good and bad. Sometimes we know too much. We're trying to interfere, but in any case, we sure didn't know much then.
What about radio? Did your family listen to the radio?
Oh, yeah.
What did you enjoy listening to?
Every evening we'd sit and listen to the likes of Phil McGee and Molly and Jack Benny and all of those, and all of us, all four of us, would sit around the radio and listen to those programs. And we'd be sure we were through at dinner by that time so that we could just give our undivided attention to these programs. And we really related to all of those radio stars back then. Fibber McGee in his closet.
Right.
And poor Molly having to put up with all of that. Jack Benny and Fred Allen, Bob Hope, you know, they all had radio programs then.
See, I guess Amos and Andy was too early for you.
Amos and Andy. And Kingfish, oh no, that was a favorite too. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because you know when we lived back east, we were pretty closely associated with black people, mm-hmm. and back then it was not bad to listen to them in their own environment doing what they do and laughing at it. Uh-huh. Now you can't do that, but
no.
Back then. It was funny.
It was funny.
Right. Yeah. So we did.
This may have been, I'm of course a little older than you, but Little Orphan Annie, did you happen to listen to that on the radio?
No.
That was a
choice. No, Red Urn of Funnies, but not.
No, I remember coming home from school and listening to Little Orphan Annie on the radio.
No, but no, I'm not sure.
I guess that was a little earlier.
I don't know. It could have been something I wouldn't have been
interested in. What about movies? Did you go to movies?
Yes, we didn't have a movie theater in Sela, but I guess when I was, the first movie I remember seeing, which would have been one that had to be taken to, was Snow White. Maybe that's the first colored Technicolor movie. I think that was in color, maybe the first one. So maybe I was 12 or something like that. Mm-hmm. But I never went to movies with my folks, but some of we guys would, there's a street corner in this little town, then we'd stand there and thumb a ride, and of course we knew everybody in town, they knew us, and so they'd take us into town because they were going, and then we'd go to a movie theater, mm-hmm. and then we'd get to another place in Yakima and stand on the corner where everybody looked for you and get a ride back. So, so we, as guys, we went to the movies, but.
That was it. What did you and Phyllis do for dating?
When we got to the point, you know, 14 or something like that, and started dating. There was before I could drive, we didn't do a whole lot. There'd be parties, you know, one family or another would have a party and they'd invite mm-hmm. 10 or 15 kids to it, and that was probably the only dancing that was done. The community was sort of run by some very strict Swedish people. And so they sat on the school board and they were never in school dances or anything.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they were against dancing, those kinds of things. So the only dancing that went on in those early years was in a home. You go to somebody's home and they'd have a little food and some soda pop and stuff, and we'd dance.
To records,
yeah, and it was really, it never really changed even when we were in high school.
School didn't have dances?
They started to towards the end, but initially they didn't, and it was.
So it was parties at home.
Yeah, parties at home mostly.
Or school and athletic events.
Athletic event. That was really the big thing. And all of us played, and so the gals, you know, their cheerleaders or they'd come and root. And then we'd go down to the cafe and have a hamburger or something after the ball game, and then walk your girl home, and then that was it. And it really did revolve mostly around athletics. Because it went on all year long. Church, we were Episcopal, and so we went into Yakima to the Episcopal Church. And Phyllis, they didn't go to church. Sometimes she'd go with Mom, and Mom and I used to go into church. I used to be an acolyte and that kind of stuff when I was younger, before I went to high school. And so Phyllis would sometimes would go with us sometimes, but it was in Yakima, which is the church that we were married in, St. Michael's, and where we had her memorial service. Mm-hmm. She passed away.
So all these things that we're worried now about, drugs and booze
And you know,
early sex and all those things were not something you were worried about.
Being a parent today, I don't know how. It's so difficult. You lose your children so young.
Well, there must have been what? Cigarettes. That was.
Oh yeah, and there's a group of kids, maybe five or six in our high school. At high school, maybe 400 kids or something like that. My graduating class, there were 65 kids or something like that. And out of that whole group, maybe there's five or six guys that smoked. Mm-hmm. And none of us, they didn't play sports, they didn't, you know, they weren't in the group.
No.
There
was no social
connection. We never did anything with them. Mm-hmm. We looked down on them. Mm-hmm. And they knew it, and so they smoked all the more, I guess. So that was the big thing was to be on the other side of that. Mm-hmm. You know, that's where everybody wanted to be.
What about scouts? Were you ever in Boy
Scouts?
Yeah,
I was in Boy Scouts, but not serious enough to ever become an Eagle Scout. Mm-hmm. But we had a scout troop, and I belonged to that for 2 or 3 years, I guess it was. And we spent most of our time out, mm-hmm. doing stuff, rather than studying for merit badges. Mm-hmm. Although a lot of stuff we did earn merit badges, but I was not a serious scout.
No.
But I enjoyed it. Yeah.
Did you do camping? Or?
Yeah. That's mostly what we did. And, around there was a lot of places to go that you didn't have to go very far to camp out, because you had a couple of rivers right there.
Fishing a part of your
that was an irritant to my father, who liked to fish, and so he'd say, well, let's go out and go fishing. So I'd say okay, and we'd go to a river and start fishing, and if they weren't biting, I just take off my clothes and start swimming, because I was bored with this. Mm. And then he'd get mad because I was scaring the fish, and so it turned out to be more of a joke than serious fishing. And the other thing was, Dad liked the lake fish, and he had an outboard motor, So every spring, he'd get the outboard motor out of the garage and get a big 55-gallon drum, fill it with water, and put the outboard motor in it. Start it up and tune it, you know, and get it running. And boy, that thing would run like a top in that barrel. Then we'd go up to the lake, and we'd get in, rent a boat, get the motor going. We'd get out in the middle of the lake, and that doggone motor would conk out. And I'd wind up rowing us back into shore. That happened more than once. And we always used to tease Dad about his motors would always run good in the backyard, but they never worked on the lake. Because that happened more than once. And we used to razz him about that. So I wasn't much of a fisherman, but Dad really did enjoy that. He would go over to the coast, he and Mom, and rent a cabin and fish for salmon in Puget Sound. And they knew these people that had these cabins, and they became good friends. So they'd do that every year. But I went once or twice, but it wasn't top on my list.
I'm looking for formative influences here.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think what you... hunting? You've come to like hunting now.
Yes, and Dad and I used to hunt. I had a... he got me a 410 and he had a 12 gauge. And Mom had a 16 gauge at one time, but she never went out with us. I don't know when she ever shot that. But Dad and I would go pheasant hunting, and we enjoyed that. That was fun. And there used to be, not like you had in South Dakota, but we had quite a few pheasants, so that was good hunting, and quail.
I guess doves are what you hunt now, isn't it?
Yeah, well, yes, and ducks.
Ducks.
Okay. And actually, last weekend I did get a pheasant.
Did you?
Over in the valley. Yeah.
In the valley, you said?
Yeah, well, yeah. Uh-huh. Sacramento Valley.
Right.
Yeah. Mm. Okay. So I am, you know, I hadn't hunted for years until about 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So I have started that again.
Mm-hmm.
And do enjoy that. It's fun to get out.
Yes, it
be
is.
With the guys and,
uh-huh.
and shoot.
Uh-huh.
It is fun. So, you know, searching for formative things, I think probably one of the greatest influences on me was my mother. She and I spent a lot of time together. Dad worked long hours, so he wasn't around the house except in the evenings. And, you know, I'd get home from school, and we'd have maybe from 4 to 6 in the evening. Before she started fixing dinner, and things like she got a magazine. I can't remember what it was now every month, but it had sort of a quiz in it. So we'd anxiously await for that magazine. And maybe I'm 10 or 11 years old now, somewhere. And then the magazine would come in the mail, and so that afternoon we'd do the quiz. Things like that. We'd sit and listen to the conventions, the Republican convention and the Democratic convention on the radio.
Mm-hmm.
We did those kinds of things.
Really?
Yeah. And we'd talk about that, and Mom would get mad. Mom, it's black or it's white? And you just got to be on one side of that or the other. And so we had great discussions about those kinds of political things. The McCarthy years, you know, when that started, that was going on just before I left home.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we were anti-communists, so we became anti-Hollywood out of all of that, which... I have remained ever since, even more so. So we used to spend a lot of time thinking about those things and paying attention to them and talking about them.
Mm-hmm.
Not so much with Dad. Dad wasn't that interested in that, but Mom was. So she probably was, I'd say certainly was the dominating influence on how I came to see the world,
mm-hmm.
how I thought about it. She was a very, very determined person. When I graduated from school, and got married and went off to Seattle. She didn't like what was happening with the school. A couple of things that happened while I was still going to school. So anyhow, she ran for the school board.
Oh.
And was elected to the school board. And so she did that for 6 or 7 years, I guess. All during the time my brother George was coming up through there. And she was not a silent person on that school board. She wasn't a troublemaker, but you know, she'd ask questions that the superintendent found a little uncomfortable to try to explain to this woman that really didn't understand how things work. And so she was an influence, a positive influence, I think, on the school board to get them to do things to look more at developing these young people to go out into the world than what they had been doing.
What was she particular?
Well,
pushing for?
We didn't have teachers that you know, could really prepare you to go out. And what really made her conscious of that was when I went to the University of Washington. And here I enrolled in engineering, and my algebra and my math skills were awful. Mm-hmm. And I graduated with a B average, or a little better than that, and an A's in math.
Mm-hmm.
And I got over there, and these my skills were so bad, I couldn't cope. And so, I would tell Mom about that. So that became part of her cause celeb, was to make sure that you're preparing these people to go on to college. Mm-hmm. Not all the kids, in fact, not that many went to college, but still, that should be available. And certainly, the kids that aren't going to college don't need algebra and calculus and those things, so don't teach it to their level. Teach it to a level of people that are going to use it, that are going to go on. So curricula was and instruction, you know, good capable teachers.
Mm-hmm.
And of course it's tough because a small school like that, you have a heck of a time attracting. Teacher, but one of the teachers I did have that during the war, it was hard to get teachers of any kind because people worked in defense and all that and made a lot more money than teaching. But this one chemistry teacher I had, she was a positive influence on me.
A woman.
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm.
She worked with Harold Urey. The guy that discovered heavy water and won the Nobel Prize. She was one of his students and did a lot of that work, you know, lab work.
Oh, for really?
It. Yeah. And of course, back then, heavy water didn't mean much to me, but she, because of her knowledge and enthusiasm for chemistry and physics, that really stimulated my interest in, you know, how fascinating that all is when you really start to understand. And so she was a very positive influence. And there was another teacher in high school who taught history. Her name was Mrs. Van. And she was just a wonderful, wonderful person. And besides having her as a history teacher, I think she was my homeroom teacher in high school for at least a couple of years. And she and I and Phyllis, the three of us, were even friends while we were in high school. But Phyllis and I wrote her every Christmas, and she wrote us. every mm-hmm. Christmas until she died. And she lived to be 80-something. Mm-hmm. So that was but she was a very positive influence on us in education and just what it is to be a nice person, because she was mm-hmm. just such a wonderful person and made us interested in history and mm-hmm. What's going on around us. So she was a very positive.
You didn't give the name of the chemistry teacher. What was? Do you remember?
I'm sorry,
her name?
I can't remember.
Well, that's okay. Yeah, maybe you'll think of it later.
Yeah, maybe, but I'm not optimistic that I will.
Well, those teachers do have a big influence.
Yeah. Darn. I'm not sure that I can remember.
That's okay. Yeah. Did you work at all? Did you have jobs in the summer?
Always, yeah. I think I got my Social Security card when I was 12.
Really?
Yeah. And I worked, it was a great place to grow up, so lucky. Because we had all these apple orchards mm. there. And we worked in the orchards all summer long. And then they usually would let us out of school.
What did you do? What sort of work?
Well, during the summer, you need to keep spraying insecticides on the trees to keep the worms from eating apples.
What did they use in those days? Do you know? Was it DDT?
No, I don't think it's DDT. I don't think we had DDT then, but in any case, it was an insecticide of some kind, and they had pipes that ran out through the orchard, and they'd mix this stuff up in a big drum back by the buildings, and then just pump it out through these pipes, and we'd take a 2-inch rubber hose and hook it on to the pipe and then drag it out through the weeds and stuff out, going down the road, spraying each of the trees.
Hmm.
And of course, we were dripping in this stuff all the time, too.
Did you wear any protective gear at all?
No. So anyhow, you do that during summer and irrigate.
How much were you paid?
Oh, I think we got maybe 50 cents an hour, 60 cents, something like that. And then in the fall, of course, they had to let us out of school, because during the war there was nobody but we school kids mm-hmm. to do all this work. Everybody else was gone.
Mm-hmm.
So they'd let us out of school for 2 or 3 weeks, and we'd go pick apples.
Mm-hmm.
In the summertime, also in August, you could pick the soft fruit, peaches, apricots, and those things, because they ripened earlier. But then in the fall, October, you'd pick the apples. And that, all of the picking, you got paid by the box. So it's piecework. But lucky, because you always, I from the time I was 12 or 13, I was buying my own clothes from then on. You know, I made enough that I could buy my own clothes. When I became 16, I was able to buy a car, mm-hmm. an old 29 Model A. So, you know, we were all sort of self-sufficient as mm-hmm. kids. We were able to take care of ourselves because we had all this job opportunity. And then there were when you got into high school, there were the warehouses that brought the fruit in from the orchards and stored it in cold storage. And so you worked there and you stacked these lugs of apples and pears and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then load them onto railroad cars and send them out. So we always had work, and that was such a plus.
Mm-hmm.
Kids today, it's so hard for them to find.
It's terrible.
Find,